The readings from Matthew 16, 13 to 28. That can be found on page 822 of the Church Bibles. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I will tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me. For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom."
Nick, thanks for reading, and great to see you, everyone. If you've not met me, my name is Sam, and I lead the 11 a.m. congregation here, but it's great to be with you this afternoon. Please do keep your Bibles open, page 822 if you've already closed them. My brother-in-law is currently studying up at Manchester University. He's studying PPE, politics, philosophy, and economics. It's what all the prime ministers seem to study, so who knows? Maybe he'll be prime minister one day. Some of it, I'm sure, is much more interesting than others, but I've genuinely found it quite thought-provoking to hear about some of his philosophy modules. He's having to think about some pretty big questions to do with life and death and morality and humanity. Why, if at all, should one try to acquire virtues? Is there even such a thing as being good? Would we be better off in a world without blame? His most recent essay was engaging with the question, is it immoral to bring a child into a world where they'll experience inevitable suffering and death? It's quite interesting to see what people have said on those topics. But presumably you want to be a bit careful who you listen to and whose thinking you are influenced by. Different philosophers will have very different answers. Some of them you'll find very persuasive. Some of them you won't want to agree with. Some you'll find downright offensive and dangerous. Jesus warned his disciples last week to beware the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. They were Israel's established religious leaders. The Jewish people had been learning theology and philosophy from them long before Jesus turned up on the scene. And Jesus has really divided opinion. It was true then, it was true when Matthew wrote this all up, and it's still true today. Other religions, including the Jewish religion, have very different answers to the human problem. Or they try to downplay the problem. Is there even such a thing as being good? Is there even such a thing as sin? Or they try to change our perspective so it doesn't look like a problem anymore. Would it be better off to be in a world without blame? Or they try to change the nature of God so that the problem is actually with him rather than with us. And we're going to see today Jesus training his disciples for the kingdom of heaven. And you'll be relieved to hear it's not a requirement to get a university degree in philosophy. You just need to listen to Jesus and not be offended by him. He said back in chapter 11, blessed is the one who is not offended by me. And especially as he starts to show his disciples the heart of the gospel message, the confession of faith for his church, will you take offense or will you keep listening to his teaching? That's where we're going to go today. Lesson one, the Christ will build a new unkillable church. I'm not quite sure whether unkillable is a word, but I've gone for it anyway. The Christ will build a new unkillable church. And we start, I think, in verse 13 with a relatively basic revision question. Verse 13, now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. It's a classic Bible study leader tactic. You might have heard it in your midweek group. First question to get people talking, what do other people say? You don't have to tell me what you think, just tell me what other people say. There's less pressure to answer that question, a range of possible answers, and you're not afraid of getting it wrong. But verse 15, he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And there's slightly higher stakes that time. It's a much more important question to get right. Jesus is training new scribes for the kingdom of heaven. He repeatedly calls them, oh, you of little faith. Have they learnt anything yet? How much have they been influenced by the Pharisees' teaching? We needn't have worried, though. They finally get something right. Verse 16, Simon Peter replied, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. Full marks, Peter, well done. You got it right. And we maybe might think this is not the hardest question, actually, especially if you've been paying attention in Matthew's gospel. The wise men at the beginning came looking for the King of the Jews. God spoke from heaven, this is my beloved son. John the Baptist heard about the deeds of the Christ. Are you the one who is to come? In the boat, the disciples worshipped him, saying, truly you are the Son of God. The Canaanite woman last week, have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. This is surely just revision. Who is Jesus? They should get this right. But even so, we mustn't be arrogant, because understanding who Jesus is an absolute miracle of God's. Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. When Peter says the Christ, the Son of the living God, he means the promised rescuing king they've been waiting for. The king God calls his son, the one who will rule over all the nations, the Jewish Messiah. And that's important because the Jewish Messiah is about to further differentiate himself, disassociate himself from the Jewish establishment. If you had any doubts about these little faith disciples and this weird little sect they were starting, or perhaps the small early church living in the shadow of much more established Judaism, or the sidelined persecuted church today, well, Jesus makes an unreservedly triumphant, bold vote of confidence in Peter and the disciples and the new gathering of God's people, the church. And verse 17, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. It's actually a massive promise, isn't it? And if you start to look at the detail, it really is quite dense what Jesus is saying. Verse 18 especially has confused people over history. It's clearly a play on words. Peter's name sounds like the word for rock. So he's saying, you are rock, and on this rock I will build my church. Simon the Rock Jonason would be his cool apostle name. But if you're from a Catholic background, you might well know this verse as the one used to justify the Pope as the leader of Christ's church on earth. A role supposedly passed down from Peter all the way to Pope Francis today. And there are quite a few reasons why I don't think that's right. There's nothing here about Peter having a succession of popes who inherit his apostolic authority. What this passage does tell us about is Peter's confession, his words, his testimony about Jesus. And so to the extent that Peter continues to proclaim Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God, he will be the rock on which Jesus builds his church. The word for church just means gathering. So it's really, really not about the building. It's about the people. We call this a church, but it's nothing more actually than quite an elaborate meeting room for the church to gather in. And Matthew's account, as he writes this all up, we've just had two big Exodus flashback miracles. Do you remember? God feeding his people in the wilderness with bread from heaven. What happens immediately next? If you read the book of Exodus, God gathers his people at the rock of Horeb, at Mount Sinai. I think Jesus is saying something quite divisive here. He's leaving the Jewish religious establishment. They are blind guides, let them alone, he says. And he's gathering a new people on a new rock for relationship with him. And verse 18, surely that's one of the coolest lines Jesus has said so far. I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. It's the word for Hades, the realm of death. Jesus is building a church on Peter's confession and it is unkillable. Death cannot have it. The church will endure forever. So just, you know, look around if you can bear the awkward glances. Well done. Some people actually did look around. Every gathering like this across the globe today is proof of Jesus keeping this promise. I listened this week to an interview by Charlie Screen about the current state of the Church of England. That could really unsettle us, what's happening at the moment in the Church of England, make us question the future of the church. But the Church of England is not the church. It's a denomination. And in that sense, Charlie in his interview says, I feel entirely calm because God is in charge. Whatever he wants will happen. And it may be that God is destroying the Church of England, and who am I to stand in his way? Which I thought was great confidence. Charlie himself is trying to restore a faithful denomination, but whether that happens or not, he knows that Jesus will build his church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. We need to go a bit quicker. So verse 19, if you're still with me, Peter is given the keys of the kingdom. You can throw away, we've got a little picture, I think, of this is not a helpful image. I don't know why I've given it to you as an image. That was kind of counterproductive in the end. This is not helpful, St. Peter standing at the pearly white gates. That's kind of what happens in jokes. That is a joke, not helpful. But the image of the keys of the kingdom is about access, people getting in. How do Peter and James and John and Matthew give us access to the kingdom of heaven? They teach us to observe everything Jesus commanded them. They proclaim Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God. The authority to bind and loose, that's actually something that the whole church seems to have been given in chapter 18. So maybe that's more evidence that these keys to the kingdom are not just given to Peter individually. And those verses talk about the forgiveness of sins. The Jesus gospel will bind people in their rejection of him, but it will also loose people from the gates of hell and make them unkillable. The Christ will build his unkillable church. But verse 20 is a bit weird. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. And logically that seems counterproductive, doesn't it? But remember, they are still in training. And so Jesus starts to teach them lesson two, which is our second point. Because Jesus is the Christ, he must be killed. Look again at verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Poor old Peter. Do you pity him at all? It's a bit of a roller coaster for him at the moment, isn't it? Such a high point that we just had, down to probably his worst moment. He's so keen, so passionate, so satanic. Jesus hasn't even been this direct with the Pharisees yet. He's called them sons of the evil one, but he actually calls Peter Satan. Not a great rock to build the church on. It's not Jesus's first run-in with Satan either. Back in chapter 4, Satan tempted Jesus. He offered him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. If Jesus would just bow down and worship him, he could have it. You can have your church. You can have all the kingdoms. But avoid so much suffering. Avoid being killed. There's another way. Jesus's rebuke here is not dissimilar. "Be gone, Satan. For it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Jesus' death and resurrection, they're probably not a surprise to us as we read this, but predictably the disciples did not get it. They did not understand. Peter doesn't even seem to engage with the idea that Jesus might rise again. He takes Jesus aside and rebukes him because he started to teach something that to Peter's ears seems downright offensive and dangerous. But there is no other way. This is the will of God. This is what it means for Jesus to be the Christ, the Son of the living God. He must go to Jerusalem. He must be killed. I think offense is a big theme in this section of Matthew. So Jesus' hometown took offense in chapter 13. The Pharisees are offended in chapter 15. In chapter 17, Jesus will tell Peter not to give offense no more than Jesus already has by his teaching. It's the word for stumbling, to cause to stumble. And the word comes up another 8 times if you include chapter 13 and chapter 18. At the beginning and end of the section. So I think it seems like this must be a big deal. What does Jesus call Peter in verse 23? You are a hindrance, or literally translated, a stumbling block. So it's that same word again. It so offends Peter that the rock becomes himself a rock of offense, a stumbling block to trip Jesus up. Can you see why Jesus doesn't want them to tell anyone he's the Christ just yet? Their training is very much still a work in progress. But they will eventually get it. Eventually, Jesus' death and resurrection will be at the heart of the gospel they proclaim, because it is God's solution to the human problem. And that's why the cross is so offensive. Jesus has been correcting their theology of sin and salvation. It turns out we are much more needy and helpless than any religious order cares to admit, because we are much more defiled, more sin-spewing than any religious establishment has the ability to change. And we must have mercy. We must have forgiveness. We must be rescued from ourselves. That's what we need. So he must be killed. It's as offensive now as it ever has been, I think. I don't like the idea of someone else paying for me. I don't want to be rescued. I'd rather stand before God on my own merit. Well, ironically, humanity's offense at Jesus led us to murder him and unwittingly fulfill God's plan for the forgiveness of sins. But continue to be offended by it now, and you will have your wish of standing before God on your own merit. And on that day, what will you give him in return for your soul? Jesus has only just begun, really, to show them these things. He'll tell them several more times before it actually happens. And the disciples' understanding, like ours, comes very slowly. So you might think it's a little bit unrealistic to expect the radical discipleship that Jesus goes on now to demand. And because Jesus is the Christ, he must be killed. And lesson three, we must lose our life. Look down with me again at verse 24. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done." In the business section of the Sunday Times, they do a How I Made It article where they tell somebody's business success story. And they also ask them five quick questions. Who's your hero? Best decision, worst decision, funniest moment, and best business tip. Listen to last week's best business tip. There it is. Keep thinking about the bigger picture. For what shall it profit a man to gain the whole world, yet lose his soul? Entrepreneurs have so much of their identity tied up with the business. Success or not, there are bigger things at stake. I was quite astonished that was in the paper, to be honest. It's written by a Christian, obviously. But his 10-year-old company was valued at, I think, over £100 million back in 2021. And yet, he knows that £100 million is really meaningless if you lose your soul. His name's Logan Nadu. He became a Christian because he had an epiphany that a career earning buckets of money would not give his life purpose. He also had a cancer diagnosis and treatment, which he says made him take stock of his life and presumably ask that philosophical question. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world but forfeits his soul? And we could probably have a whole talk just on that verse. We don't have time. But it's the logic behind the radical discipleship that Jesus requires if you are going to follow him. And we've actually heard it quite a lot in Matthew's gospel. Follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. You will be hated by all for my name's sake. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. So this is not really new territory. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And maybe the only difference now is that our cross is explicitly linked to Jesus' own journey to the cross, and whether that will result in offense or faith. Considering Jesus is establishing an unkillable, undying church, it's sort of funny that the pattern for the king and his followers is take up your cross and lose your life. But that radical surrendering of life now comes directly from our confidence in sins forgiven, life found, life saved, life promised. We're opting into Jesus' guarantee that the gates of hell shall not prevail against his church. That 3 days later, Jesus would be raised from the dead. And verse 27, that the Son of Man will return with his angels in the glory of his Father to repay each person according to what we have done. I wonder how much would you expect to pay for your eternal soul? How much do you think your life is worth? Jesus won't accept any lowball offers. He's calling disciples to follow him to death and back because the value of your soul is so great it is worth losing your life for. In fact, more than that, it was worth him losing his life for. You might like to chat at the end about what you think it means, what it might look like to deny yourself and lose your life for Jesus' sake. In the first instance, I don't think it was hard for them to apply. Losing your life was literally what the disciples did. And many Christians continue to do that today as well. But this is not just for the apostles or the persecuted church. Jesus says if anyone would come after him, and if it's absolute surrender, then there's no part of our lives or our bank accounts or our aspirations or our careers or our relationships that has not now come under the rule of the Christ, the Son of the living God, who was killed and rose again. Will you be offended? Or will you deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow him?